And this boy scuttles onward over the bridge, wrapped about in his older brother's greatcoat, whose tattered hem drags on the ground and soaks up the puddles. His nose runs prodigiously, and he blots it once or twice upon the ink. About him the wind gets up, and the river churns and leaps in its crenellated bounds, like a horse nervous before a storm. At Greenland Dock, the rain is the least of the boy's concerns. Here he is suddenly engulfed in a cloud of mood, which lies as heavy as a foot across his windpipe. Oh, what is it? It is like a mist, hangs heavy over the buildings and the ships, puts tears in the eyes and a sob in the throat. The boy, whose mother lies coughing and white in their cellar lodgings, is near blinded by his own anguish. He wants nothing more than to run home to her, but in the rain and mist and sorrow loses his bearings and circuits the squat, dark buildings once, then twice, in the stink of murdered whales and the looming sight of tall ships. It is a labourer who seizes this boy by the shoulders and points him homeward, and who eventually delivers that crumpled paper to Mr. Hancock's shack. The merchant leans so studiously that his nose almost touches the water. The mermaid trembles and glitters within, and her largeness has become a fume that escapes from its surface and intoxicates him. Mr. Hancock has himself never seen the sea, but at the mermaid's side he feels it, vast and boisterous, freezing and impassive. When this message is brought to his elbow, he is not surprised by its contents. Even so,
"Why was I not told of this?"
he demands of the labourer who stands at his elbow.
"You were told."
"So, where am I to keep my goods?"
He grips the rim of the vat in panic.
"It don't signify, but we are bound to pull down this place come Wednesday, if it does not tumble down of its own accord."
He puts his hand upon a beam, and the whole building rattles and lurches in a most satisfying demonstration of its own dereliction. A great nest of old rushes and one decayed mouse rattle to the dirt floor. Mr. Hancock begins to sweat. He gazes again into the water.
"What is to be done?" "I need more time," he says.
"There is no more time."
"I can pay you."
"No."
The labourer twists his chafed fingers together and looks embarrassed.
"If you want the truth, we're all agreed that this place must go. 'Tis haunted. Everybody feels it lately. The ghastly sadness as comes off it, and can be felt within it."
"No, no,"
says Mr. Hancock in some panic.
"You must feel it. I know you do."
He clears his throat and leans nearer.
"Mr. Wattle, the overseer, he lost his little girl 2 weeks ago. Drowned."
He jerks his head yonder.
"In the river, not 100 feet from here. Nobody's fault. She must have wandered in her play. But that sadness, such grief, we all feel it. A loss like that does tend to touch everybody. Has grown ever stronger since. We're all agreed we shall burn the place. There's no price. We'll change our minds, sir."
Since the men of Greenland Dock have formed their own convictions as to the source of the strange miasma, Mr. Hancock feels entitled to ape outrage.
"And so I must remove my stock?"
he demands.
"Aye."
"Then I need,"
he thinks, rests his hand on the rim of the vat.
"I need to move this."
The labourer snorts.
"'Tis not my job."
He glances curiously at the vat of dirty water.
"That?
What of it?"
"Why, it is just a filthy, discarded thing.
Why should you want it? It was doing no harm here until you determined to pull this building down,"
Mr. Hancock says aggrievedly. He digs in his pockets and draws out a wad of clean notes.
Here, how much would it cost you? I want it done at night.
He is thinking quickly. Where to move the thing? Are there other likely outbuildings? Can it be concealed somewhere about his offices?
I need it brought to Blackheath, he says with decision. To Blackheath, and then no more need be said about it.
I do not understand, says the labourer.
From the vat, a gasp, a sigh, a leap of liquid into the air. And thus it is done, very swiftly and under cover of darkness. Mr. Hancock seals the rendering vat with a discarded piece of mainsail and sees it loaded onto casters and thence a raft by four bleary workmen kept from their beds to do they know not what for the promise of a purse of money apiece. Thus it is transported by raft along the river to Greenwich, while he sits with his back against it, rocking gently upon the black water. Thence he and the vat are taken up the hill to the heath by bullock cart. It is dark beyond darkness, not a light on the road, just empty nothing before them, and the whistling of the dry grass in the wind. He is alert to footsteps, and flinches at the heard swoop of some night bird passing near, mistaking the sigh of its feathers for a blade unsheathed. Surely he is glad to see the gable of his own empty house come into view. He feels no guilt that, before his wife sleeps her first night there, he has already concealed a secret within it. The grass hisses.
Good to be in the clean air,
says one of the men Mr. Hancock's labourer friend has hired.
Aye,
says another, tight-lipped. He is afraid of the contents of the vat, wanted nothing of it.
You're to help, Mr. Hancock snapped at him. You want to see the thing gone, do you not?
He sits now hugging his own shoulders, chin tucked into his collar. The third man hesitates.
But the queerest thing, he says, I still do feel sad. Ghosts are tenacious, squeaks the labourer.
Aye, that's so.
His mate shrugs, shivering off a shaft of sudden chill.
My wife's mother, God rest her, followed us to three different lodgings when first we were married. We knew she was there by the smell of burnt porridge. What fools! It took us 7 years to perceive that she was attached to the hearth brush all along, and after we gave it a Christian burial, she troubled us no more.
They pass along the drive, skirting the stables, and draw the cart to a stop at the edge of the lawn.
It is to go in the folly,
says Mr. Hancock, gesturing to its shadow at the far end of the garden.
I want no wheel marks on the grass.
What? And we are to carry it down the hill?
Says the labourer's mate, leaping down from his seat.
I'll do no such thing, says the first, backing away. Oh, no, I'll not touch it.
Say, what's your trouble? Are you averse to hard work now?
But the second workman is apprehensive himself, a peculiar dread taking up the space of his heart. Something is amiss, although he cannot say what.
Bring it down, says Mr. Hancock. I shall help you.
The five men stagger with the vat through the enclosing trees. The moon being slender, there is little to be seen, but something peculiar to be heard. A tapping from within the metal, as if tiny bubbles were popping against it, a sweeping sound as if flesh brushed against it. And once a long, sonorous note of metal struck, which trembles through the vat and through again. At this, the first labourer nearly bursts out weeping.
"Hush, you,"
says his mate, unwilling to express the perturbation he feels.
You are entertaining demons. It takes some hours to maneuver its dead weight and fearful splosh down the staircase. The copper sides of the barrel scrape against the mussel shells, and the canvas covering rucks up. Cobwebs and birds' bones spin on the surface of the water, and then are gulped out of sight. Dawn is coming in by the time they have heaved and panted the thing into the furthest chamber of the grotto.
"Thank you, gentlemen,"
says Mr. Hancock, as he leads them back into the light.
"You have done me a great service."
"Sir,"
says the moribullion to the labourers, most grave now, for he has had his ear pressed to the copper for hours, and heard the weird stirrings within, and felt the tug of something most unnatural.
"What did we deliver you?"
"'Tis of no concern to you."
"I judge that it is," he retorts,
but his companion gives him a jab in the ribs.
"No, no," he whispers. "Let us not inquire. Let us leave this place and never return." "Call it contraband," says Mr. Hancock. "Call it rum, if you wish."
"But still, I should like to..."
The labourer peers over Mr. Hancock's shoulder.
"I have not had a proper look."
He moves forward, but Mr. Hancock holds him at arm's length and stares him down.
"Go,"
he says. The first of the men is already pacing away. From up the hill comes the peaceful sound of the oxen cropping the long black grass.
"Oh, now!"
But Mr. Hancock shakes his head, and they are away with many backward glances. The cart creaks into darkness, and Mr. Hancock stands beneath the pillars of the folly until he judges himself to be most certainly alone. Then he returns to the depths of the grotto beneath. The greenish ghost light quivers up the walls. He takes out his knife and sets about cutting the canvas from the mouth of the vat. It comes away with a sigh that echoes around the curved metal walls and out into the chamber. Beneath the vaulted ceiling, the noise of the water is magnified most peculiar and almost vocal. A tiny groan, as if a child there were stirring from sleep. He touches the cold belly, hears the slop of movement within. A loss is not a void. A loss is a presence all its own. A loss takes up space. A loss is born just as any other thing that lives. You think your arms empty, but I shall lie in them. I have outgrown all the room you gave me. No more swimming for me, no more flying in the deep. Gone are the days I flipped imminent head over budding heels. A nimble, half-formed one could have become many things. Now I crouch, pinned in, held fast, deep underground, with my limbs folded in, and my form is inescapable. You know what I am. And what I am not, but you will not look upon me. Nevertheless, my streams, like fingers, find a way. Bury me deep, I shall seep to the surface. My stirrings are as earthquakes. In my quickening, I shall stretch limbs, arch neck, test muscles. My hunched spine curves like an egg. I shall shoulder aside these foundations that pin me. In the end, I am here. I am here. You are not alone. Here I am. I am grief, the living child of your suffering. I am the grief that sits within you. I am the grief that sits between you. You will bury me, but I shall rise up. You will not know me, but I shall make myself known to you.
Chapter 13. Their removal to their great new house is sombre, for neither Mr. nor Mrs. Hancock is much inclined to optimism. Indeed, if their souls had found a way to communicate, they would have found them twinned in their sense of futility. He thinking,
"My ambitions are beyond me."
She, "It is all over. I am unmatched to the task he has set me." Then Bridget cannot accompany them, since her mother will not have her so far distant, and the cat swipes and yowls and will not be entreated into a sack to take a place on the wagon. She whisks out of the yard door before she can be caught, and is away up the pear tree and over the wall.
"She does not know we are not coming back,"
says Mr. Hancock.
"She has no idea that she will return here to find the doors locked and no warm fire or saucer of milk awaiting her."
"We never fed her milk but what she stole," says Suki, "so that will cause her no dismay."
Angelica rubs his shoulder.
"There will be other cats."
But her husband does not care for other cats, only his own, who has unwittingly become a nomad, a friendless wanderer in the cold.
"I never abandoned a thing in my life," he says.
"Cats make their own way,"
Angelica tells him, but she, too, feels traitorous. When the time comes, the women approach Blackheath by carriage, which makes straining, creaking progress up the hill. Suki sits bolt upright at the window, her eyes alert to everything. The houses grow sparser but handsomer, and the shady road is quiet, save for a gang of red-coated young men who idle, laughing. Beyond the ditches on either side of the road is nodding, sun-touched wilderness, all figured with birdsong, and the trees tall and graceful above their bed of bluebells.
"Is this where we are to live?"
asks Suki, her palm on the glass. They rise up to the plateau. The grass is a broad, sunny swish as far as the horizon, tipped with light.
"And so where are we to buy our victuals? All our everyday needs?"
She has never lived but on a street before, with tailor and butcher and carpenter no more than a trot down trusty flagstones.
"As if I know,"
says Angelica, who is curled on the seat with her forehead on the window. The heath looks to her as if it were reflected in the curve of a banker's glass, its expanse magnified, and the houses and trees that fringe it melting away small in the distance.
"I shall make inquiries."
Suki takes out her pocketbook.
"It may be that we must order up from Greenwich. That will be an expense." "Hang the expense."
Angelica closes her eyes. The carriage shakes her like a nursemaid. And now it is that they arrive at the entrance of their home, the narrow drive that curves modestly away from the road so that only the roof of the house might be seen by those strolling on the heath.
"Oh,"
says Suki, and her nose will press no closer against her window.
"I say the expense was hanged some time back."
She stares and stares.
"And this is where we are to live? Oh, come now, Mrs. Hancock, lift up your head. Look at it."
"I already saw it."
"Do not pretend this gives you no pleasure."
For the house is as delightful as ever it was, from the symmetry of its windows to the curve of its hillock, to the pretty Dutch gables of its outbuildings.
"So well appointed! For I believe we have a dairy! Look, dear! And a vegetable garden! Oh, why did you not tell me it would be so fine?"
Indoors, it is as fine as fine, its floors all a-gleaming, and the fat women and infants on the ceiling puffed up with pride. And there are 16 leather fire buckets hung up in the back hall, and copper boilers pristine in the kitchen, and down below, in the cold bowels of the house, a vaulted gallery of meat hooks. There is a room for billiards, and for sewing, and for reading, and in all, it looms over Angelica, the most sumptuous of monsters.
"It will kill me,"
she thinks, and cannot bear to watch Suki dash hither and thither, near fevered with the work before her.
"Inquire as to gardener," she scribbles in her book. "See to character of new maids, fumigate all the attics, send for wallpaper samples."
To Angelica, she cries,
"Oh, madam, won't this be fun?"
and does not mind that she has no reply. Her aunt only stands upon the shining floor with something like dismay writ all over her face. But Suki vibrates with the thrill of it all, for this is no longer the straitened training she has known hitherto, the trifling management of closet and cupboard, but a situation of which she might call herself mistress, by any reasonable definition of the word. She will know the proper place of everything, and furthermore have the authority to move it about. Nobody but she will dictate washing and cleaning, polishing and buffing. And when it comes to feeding the house, Suki alone will ordain how many cutlets are to be ordered, will turn the grocer's offerings over in her hands and decide their quality, will choose what fruits are enjoyed fresh and what bottled for a comfortable winter. She never was so unfettered in all her life. But at the same time, she is greatly afraid.
"This is an entirely new sort of place," she observes, "for a new manner of living. I must not appear superfluous to it, or they will send me away." "And so we shall inspect the gardens," she prattles on to Angelica, "and see what grows there, what must yet be done. It will be a great economy to have our fruits and vegetables grown here. And I would like a clutch of chickens to rear, and a..."
"Have you ever raised livestock before?" asks Angelica faintly.
"Kept a kitchen garden?" "Details! Details! I have a book! I shall hire help in. And would you not like a little brood of speckled chicks? Think of them pecking about!"
Angelica closes her eyes.
"This is beyond me. I cannot think where to start." "I can. Come with me to the kitchen, and we shall make up some great lists. A list of what we have, a list of what we do not, and a list of what we must do with it all once it is got."
Suki hops from foot to foot, her face flushed.
"So much to do, Mrs. Hancock. It will keep us eternally occupied, and we may do it just as we choose. And the men can say nothing but thank ye. I had better talk to my uncle, for you and I shall need to hire a full complement of staff to effect all the plans I have in mind."
"Excuse me," says Angelica abruptly.
"I am tired. You will permit me rest a while."
Upstairs, she pauses on the landing, but Suki follows behind, her face all knitted with anxiety.
"Can you not let me be?" demands Angelica.
Suki hesitates and steels herself.
"You need to tell him," she says. "If there is not to be a child, he must know."
Angelica says nothing. She closes her eyes. She cannot think what to do.
"I do not belong here," she thinks. "If I were mistress of this house, then this baby would not have been aborted."
She was afraid of her narrowing world, but now, without its safe enclosure, she finds she is nobody. Angelica Neal is quite gone. Angelica Hancock is already hollow as a bleached shell. She places a hand to her brow.
"He has not even noticed," she says. "He does not care. He asks nothing about it." "I have lost everything." "Come, we're not 2 minutes inside the door," says Suki, although she is fierce afraid to see such faltering in her aunt. "It will all change now we are here."
She takes a little step forward.
"Please."
But Angelica knits her brow and shakes her head. A new wave of dejection seems to have settled upon her since arriving on the heath. Now she feels most especially as if she were grasping at something quite impossible to seize upon.
"Leave me be," she says.
Alone on the landing, she remembers that she does not know where her bedroom might be. Many doors stand before her, all closed. She tries the first, and it is a library. The second, a little music room, all pearl-coloured and glowing with the window shades drawn up. Her eye passes over her own clavichord to the harp and viol and flute beyond, and her stomach tightens.
"He must mean me to learn to play them," she thinks, "when I am not even equal to the task of ordering the kitchen."
She opens doors until she discovers a bedroom, a small one hung with yellow damask, good for a spinster visitor, and once within sits down on the bed, quite numbed. She longs for the bare little kitchen at Union Street, where she could chop apples and peel carrots with innocent assiduity under the supervision of girls half her age.
"What a fool," she thinks, "to imagine I had the measure of any domestic life. And what am I to do now?"
She finds herself at a peculiar impasse, the first, perhaps, in her life, and it is not caused by obstacles, but by the lack of them.
"What now?" she thinks. "What now? What now?"
and knots her fingers and furrows her brow. Outside her window, the heath lies flat to the horizon, its sky churning. The wind roils the clouds and the gorse bushes alike. Each new day grows longer and hotter than its predecessor. Chapter 14. June 1786. The summer grows hot and ripe, bleaching the grass of the heath to a perfect rustling sweep of gold, where grasshoppers creak incessantly to one another, but where few walk in the heat of the day. Now ought to be the time for ventures into London, or Greenwich, or out by boat to the country homes of friends, the long, bright days being so unwelcoming to footpads. The Hancocks, however, go nowhere. Suki busies herself with hiring a coterie of servants, from cook to lady's maid to footman, who look her up and down with amused pity, and who smirk when she gives them their orders in her little thin voice. The promised dancing master comes too, and laments her slumped shoulders, her weak ankles. The French master decries her accent, the Latin master her ignorance, and in this great house she feels a coarse hick of a girl, good for nothing. Of all this she says nothing, but bites her lip and smiles anon. Angelica, meanwhile, robbed of the tasks of an increasing wife, no cradle to send for, no tiny caps to trim, finds that her days roll on with terrifying futility. No longer are her moments diminishing. Each dawn sees her no closer to any great event. She can anticipate neither the beginning of any new life nor the end of her own. She remains in genteel suspension, her time stretching inexorably before her. As for her husband, where is he? Off about his inscrutable business in the city? Or at the far-away Marylebone site of his new houses? He is never to be found about the house, unless he is lingering at one of the back windows, staring without sight at some far distant point. More often she sees him trudging up the hill from the place where the garden gives way to wilderness.
"Some assignation?" she wonders,
keeping her eyes closed on the blue mooned night as he stumbles about the bedroom.
"Does he go to meet a lover? Has he found a secret way to Greenwich?"
But she hears no carriage on the drive, and no lantern light has crossed her window, and as he bends over the bed, she detects no liquor on his breath, and no perfume on his stock. Where, then, does he take himself all night? She thinks of her other failures, the twist of Georgie's face when he said, what was it he said?
"I'm sick of you."
And the dread shame of clutching Mrs. Chapel's ankles in her parlour all stripped bare. She hugs her arms about herself, and feels her body slacker and less seizable than it once was, which inspires desire in nobody who looks upon it, and cannot sustain the flickerings of any life but her own. Her closed eyelids burn with tears, but she resolves to give her husband no hint that his presence has penetrated her sleep, not to flinch at the cold breeze that follows him into the room, or roll over to open her arms to him. She deepens her breathing and nestles closer into her bedclothes. But at her turned back, she feels him lie still and wakeful for a good long time. She thinks, "Our bad luck began when we acquired this place. We have overreached ourselves, that is certain. But is there not some horrid miasma here? It taints her very lungs. Some mornings it seems that all she breathes is grief."
"Another note," says Suki, "from our neighbours."
"We have no neighbours," says Angelica. She licks the end of her thread and squints to press it into her needle, for they are, as ever, about the business of housekeeping, and in the spirit of furious industry, Suki has devised a code. Each room of the house is assigned its own symbol, spined and hooked as a skeleton key, and with scarlet thread they stitch it upon every bit of cloth that might be carried off from its designated place. The laundry house has levelling tendencies, and without proper oversight might send the fine wool blanket from the library to lie upon the cook's bed.
"Certainly we do have neighbours," says Suki. "Not 300 yards away."
"We do not pass them in the street, and they do not nuisance us through the walls," says Angelica. "Therefore how can they be anything to us?"
"Well, we are something to them," Suki cajoles, "and grateful we should be for it."
"Perhaps you should. I dare say they have sons it will be worth your while to know one day. But I..." Her stitching is large and ugly, her fingers fumbling. "I shall have to unpick those tonight," thinks Suki. She lets no criticism pass her lips, but she feels as if she were stretched tight, scampering always just before her aunt to cheer her, protect her, encourage her. "I am not their sort," Angelica continues, frowning over her sorry work. "They would not have desired to look upon me before. They would have shielded their daughter's eyes from me, and their sons." She runs her finger with a needle and jerks back, spitting like a cat. A bead of blood swells there.
"Not on the linen," cries Suki. "We shall never get the mark out. I would rather you even blotted it on your apron."
"I believe they come to stare." Angelica sucks the blood away and inspects as it bubbles up again. "I am a freak to them."
"You are the wife of a good man and mistress of this house, the same as any."
"They come only for curiosity. I will not have them."
"I have already invited them here," says Suki, "for tea, tomorrow. The ladies only, of course. That is the thing to do, you know, the right thing."
"Oh, the ladies, the worst of all. The only thing worse than the ladies would be their gentlemen."
"Hush, hush," Suki suppresses her impatience. "Remember, you are Mrs. Hancock now. Once the ladies have taken a look at us, there will be other invitations. You will like that, to be back in society."
"Not their society."
To distract her from her petulance and remind her of her position, Suki bullies her through the messuages of which she is mistress. The dairy, the brewhouse, the laundry, and out into the orchard where the grasshoppers buzz in the grass and leap like popped buttons at the women's passing. The two maids, hired from the village of Blackheath, follow behind, hung about with baskets and coarse bags, and sharing the weight of the ladder between them as they teeter unwillingly on their pattens, picking their feet up high. The gnarled and reaching arms of the apple trees are all a-rustle, their leaves crisp and vivid and cool. Suki stops to draw a bough down towards her and inspect the pale fruit growing there, the largest, no bigger than a hen's egg.
"Look,"
she says, brushing a ladybird from the curled leaves.
"'Twas not for this I became a great lady,"
Angelica grumbles.
"And when did you do that?"
Suki lets the bough go, and it hurtles upward, setting all its neighbours a-swaying.
"Nobody, elevated as we have been, must see to her own gardens." "This is exactly our duty." "What? You thought you would be at your leisure because you are kept? Your work has hardly begun."
"I had better remained where I was," says Angelica, pulling her straw hat down over her face. Sunlight speckles through its weave. She shades her eyes. Onward they walk to the first of the plum trees, whose perfumed boughs droop with the weight of their fruit.
"We have plums enough," says Angelica. "I'm sick of the sight of them." "Well, be sick. They are hardly into their season, and we must preserve a good many more before winter."
The girls set the ladder up against a tree.
"Help us?" asks Suki. "You need not climb, dear. Just pick the ones closest to hand."
Angelica says nothing. She turns her face towards where Greenwich might be, but the basin of land beneath them is filled up still with a dawn's mist, and she does not see the spire of Alfeges, or the domes of the naval hospital, or even a single ship's mast, except through a veil of haze. The river, with its gilded barks and swift clippers, has been vanished all away, and she is alone on her hillside.
"Come."
Suki takes her arm. She does not like the maids to see her aunt so deviled. They have a cruel way of watching.
"Collect those that have already fallen, if you prefer. That's an easy task."
"Don't it feel worse out here?" Angelica asks, for a tide of particular sorrow has taken her. She sighs as if she could empty her whole heart. Another breeze rushes up the hill, and she must sigh again. She feels the sorrow filling her lungs. Suki shakes her head. The maids lack a certain sprightliness of manner, she thinks, but then her aunt is a most subduing influence. It is hard to guard one's own happinesses against one who is so very much in denial of them. Suki thinks,
"It takes all I have, even to affect happiness in her presence. She will suck it all from me. I cannot fight her much longer. Is this how it is always to be?"
Aloud, she says not a word. The plums at the tree's feet are some of them reduced to sludge, and their brandied smell is thick upon the air.
"Ugh," says Angelica, "they're rotted away." "Not all of them."
If Suki is impatient, her voice hardly betrays it.
"See? These are good."
She nudges one with the side of her paten, and it rolls flesh tender and true on all its faces. Flies green as opals rise peevishly.
"We must gather them up before any more go bad."
But Angelica cannot be entreated.
"A fatuous endeavour," she says. "Everything is rotting." "Then will you go to the raspberry patch? See if the heat has ripened any,"
persists Suki, who would find true pleasure in the flourishing of her land, were she permitted, to walk out into birdsong and the damp soil air and discover what secret doings the plants have been about overnight. She feels as if she were a child who has discovered an elf land. And yet she knows that Angelica is best appealed to through her appetite, and adds rashly,
"There may be enough to make a little tart, or to garnish a fine duck, if cook is disposed to roast it."
"The more you try to please me," says Angelica, "the less you succeed." She starts back towards the house, the trills of a blackbird knitting about her. Behind her, the girls snort with laughter and are up the tree with a swish of branches. They pass the plums from hand to hand and lay them in their baskets as gently as eggs, watching the scene through the leaves.
"She has such queer moments,"
Suki explains. But the girls extend no friendliness to her, only roll their eyes at one another. Wishing for a friend, she seizes up her skirts and pursues Angelica up the hill through the long, dry grass.
"Mrs. Hancock,"
she admonishes.
"Oh, leave me be." "You are mistress of this house. Why do you give it none of your time?"
Angelica is walking fast up the steps to the French windows, her arms clasped about herself.
"And what will you do now?"
persists Suki, pushing her hat away from her face so it dangles on its ribbon between her shoulder blades.
"But go back to your chamber and lie on your silly bed and read your silly books or some other nonsense thing that benefits nobody. Do you ever look beyond yourself?"
She follows her into the atrium, where the marble floor gleams.
"You got what you wanted,"
she says, and her voice echoes up the stairs.
"He gave you all this, and still you keep secrets from him. Still you are not happy." "What business is it of yours?"
Angelica shakes her jacket from her shoulders and lets it fall to the floor as she storms on. She does not look back. She makes for her rooms.
"You have burdened me with it enough that it might as well be my business. This is not my own house, and yet I can account for every last bolster in it, while you..."
Angelica's impatience erupts.
"Nipping, yipping thing, snitch. On and on you go, Suki Lippard. You've tongue enough for two sets of teeth. If you wish to make such footling your life, then so be it. I'm glad to say it's not mine, nor ever will be. Trouble me with it no more."
Suki stands at the foot of the stairs, her hat tossed back and her hands on her hips, her mother's attitude.
"But it is your life," she says. "It must be. Or what are you?"
Upstairs, Angelica's door slams. Chapter 15. Mr. Hancock has watched it all from the back window, the women in their straw hats and drab everyday gowns going about their work with some animation. Could this be the same Angelica Neal he married? At this distance, she is a woman as ordinary-looking as any other, not the shining and laughing ornament he had imagined keeping in his house. And that whisper again, "It can never be." The feeling of great loss, as if the soft and lavish wife he chose has already died, and it is only her shell carrying on. That distant shore he once envisaged is a mirage. What he thought were lush mountains are only churning clouds. When she bursts into the room, not moments later, he is unprepared for her storm of misery.
"Oh, I cannot bear it," she cries. "There will be visitors coming, and I cannot think. I do not know how to speak to them at all. They will come to mock me, I'm sure of it."
"Who would mock you?" he asks. "These are people like us. You would do well to socialize with them. They are people of a finer water, as we ourselves are now. I have chose the most splendid woman in London, and I have put her in an entirely splendid house. What can they find to laugh at?"
"Oh, as many things as there are inches of my body. You, sir, are perhaps their sort, or will shortly become so, but you have made a poor choice of wife. I can only hold you back."
He thinks, for the first time, "Is she touched by the same thing as I am myself? This fascinating melancholy that draws me back and back. Perhaps it's my asthma has infected her, too." She begins to weep. Her tears are fat as pearls.
because I'm so filled with apprehension, she says. I see that I shall fail you in the tasks you ask of me. I shall disappoint you in multitude ways. I cannot cook or sew or brew. I'm afraid I cannot appear pleasantly to our neighbours of this class and match their manners, for I have no education in them. She draws breath and seems to compose herself. I am fearful afraid, sir. At this he feels he might break down weeping. This is the moment he should tell her of the mermaid, whose grief and largeness seems to seize him more each day. But he is afraid what will happen if he takes the cap of such a secret. I am here, he says weakly. Then he reaches through the great fog to observe at last what is true. I have neglected you, he says. And I you? She looks up at him with the purest expression of grief he has ever seen in his life, so that he kneels down before her and puts his chin on her knees. She takes off his wig and strokes her hands across his stubbly head, which movement both soothes her and eases him. It is something like having his hair stroked by his mother, although he little remembers her. She explores the corners of his skull as it terminates behind his ears and kneads her fingertips over his crown. If their joy has been spoilt, it is by his bringing the creature into it. He draws breath, but cannot speak it. He remains there some minutes longer, submitting to her touch, which he has not known for what seems a great long time. I need to tell you something, she says presently.
What's that?
She speaks so quietly. She might as well be only moving her lips. But he catches her words. I lost the child. And ah, there it is, the feeling again of something snatched from his grip. He feels a tickle on his cheek and looks up. A lock of her hair has slipped loose and wavers in the air between her face and his. His poor wife, who was hitherto brisked about life, is sad and fading already.
I have neglected you, he says.
No, no. The crease between her eyebrows never fades now. What could you have done? He rises so his forehead is pressed against hers.
I could have helped you. That is something.
I've been so absorbed in... But he cannot say it. Instead, he embraces his wife, breathing in her scent of apple leaves and house dust. He hears the sharp snatch of her breath, the shudder of grief that runs through her.
There, there, my poor little pigeon. 'Tis all right.
He pulls away to look into her blotchy, swollen face. Her lips are wet and wobbly, like a child's. You're not angry with me? She asks.
No, not at all.
How can he be? He feels nothing at all, only a dull vindication.
Of course this would happen. Of course no happiness could come to us.
He cannot recall in this moment of confirmation the emotion of kindness, but he recalls its words and how they are used, and he reaches deeply for them now as he presses her hands in his.
This is a small sorrow sent to try us, that is all. Am I not your husband?
You are a good husband.
There, and so I would never be angry with you for such a sad thing.
She smiles damply. And he thinks,
she's not the woman I met.
And he thinks, she can only get older henceforth. And the older one gets, the narrower one's opportunities for happiness become.
and he thinks, so what will be next? Will he come in one day to find her laid out dead? He squeezes her fiercely to him for a moment.
I am relieved, she says with some surprise. I do feel as if some weight has fallen from me. I could not tell you, but now that I have, she draws a deep, quivering breath. Yes, 'tis better.
She stands, throws back her shoulders. She seems taller than she has in many months.
Perhaps I'm more myself.
He stares out of the window. He feels as if he were on a ship in the middle of a great ocean, too far from home to turn about, but so distant from the strange shore ahead that his craft will be buffeted apart by the waves before it reaches it.
Mr. Hancock, she whispers.
And he turns and sees her, golden as a beacon. Chapter 16. Those visiting are the ladies of the Crawford family, their fortune forged in a pin factory. Mrs. Crawford, a matron with a voice so loud that Suki, taking air at the open library window, hears it quite clearly as she watches the party arrive.
Well, you would think they would have had it painted, would you not? For that is the first thing I always do on acquiring a new home.
Is accompanied by her daughter, Mrs. Flowerday, whose step is sprightly and whose curls bounce under her cape, and also Miss Crawford, a sister of the husband, narrow-shouldered and fidgeting.
"Mama," says Mrs. Flowerday, "now be kind. Not everybody has your instinct, and particularly not this lady. She is from quite a different world."
Miss Crawford says nothing. But then she is overburdened by some great, unseasonable armful of rabbit fur and wool calamanco. Suki, still stung by Angelica's earlier rebuke, is inclined to closet herself for the rest of the day.
"But if I have displeased her," she frets, "she may want me here no longer. I must endeavour to do better."
And thus she steels herself to play hostess, and leaves the room in sedate haste. On the landing, she taps on Angelica's door.
"They're arrived,"
she says, as the bell rings.
"Mmm,"
from within.
"You will come down, will you not?"
"Oh, do not abandon me to these strangers' scrutiny."
"By and by." "They're here now."
A scuffle of whispers behind the door.
"Have you Catty in there with you? I've been looking for her all day."
"She's helping me get ready," says Angelica crossly.
"If you want me, and you want me decent, you will have to wait."
The women's voices are loud at the door. They're on the step.
"I suppose I've no choice,"
sniffs Suki. She puts her palm flat on the door and adds in a softer tone,
"Only do not leave me alone with them too long."
The bell is jangling, and she scoots down the stairs as the footman crosses the atrium.
"Give me time," she hisses to him. "Send the hot water."
In the parlour, tarts and tea bowls are laid out, just as she oversaw them. The light is poor, but it collects itself within each bowl to beam through the porcelain like so many bottle-caught glowworms. Suki has only a moment to arrange herself before the door opens and her visitors arrive in such a chaffing of cloth and clacking of shoes and clucking of voices that her thoughts desert her. She is kissed and inspected and smiles most prettily, but the eyes of Mrs. Crawford and her daughter are everywhere. They look from the tea bowls to the wallpaper to the bookcase with such goggling energy they risk snapping their necks. Mrs. Flowerday, a powdered young bride, takes her by the elbows to look her up and down.
"And you are Miss Hancock," she says, "not Mrs."
"I am Mr. Hancock's niece," she says, "Miss Lippard."
Having so many elder sisters, she is unused to the title, and furthermore does not know how much familiarity to extend to these women. So her own name leaves her lips as if it were a question.
Susanna?
Her face feels hot.
Mrs. Hancock will join us by and by.
Oh!
Mrs. Flowerday emits a gurgle of laughter.
I thought you could not be her. I've heard so much about her beauty.
Miss Crawford is still carrying her great bundle, and now she begins to remove clouts from it one by one, fur followed by dense tabby and calamanco, and finally an embroidered shawl. The women gather about.
Oh, little man, are you awake?
Did you have a long sleep? Oh, yes, you did.
Such a good boy to sleep so long.
For within the bundle is a screw-faced baby, his hair awry with sweat, who blinks irritably at the company and brings his paws up to his eyes. His wrists are mere creases, and he has dimples for knuckles.
Our handsome fellow. Miss Lippard, you are honoured by baby's first visit.
Oh, says Suki. Will you have some tea?
But even once seated, they fuss about the child, whom the spinster Miss Crawford bounces upon her knee, his little head lolls back upon her bosom.
I suppose he is your first, says Suki to Mrs. Flowerday.
Not only that, but my own first grandchild, says Mrs. Crawford. A wonder you could guess it. But do you know, when he was born, I did not care for him at all. I only sought to satisfy myself that dear Caro was in no danger, for all infants are much of a muchness, but there is only one Caroline. Or so I then thought.
She leans over and seizes baby's cheek between thumb and forefinger.
Was I wrong? Was I not wrong? Are you not the dearest princeling that ever there was?
She turns back to Suki.
I make a dote of him now, so all is forgiven.
A smile flickers across Miss Crawford's face. She is something about 40 and handsome in an austere, big-nosed way. She holds the infant without anxiety, her eyes elsewhere. She barely marks it when he suddenly screws up his face and lets out a squall of effort, but lets him clasp his fists around her fingers with the placidity of habit. He braces his tiny feet upon her legs and arches his back to pull himself upright, his eyes goggling with the strain and a bubble of drool glistening on his slackening lips.
A fine, strong fellow, a true Hercules.
You would not guess he was only 3 months old,
his mother and grandmother exclaim, but Miss Crawford herself says nothing. She merely grips his fat wrists as he teeters on her lap, loose-strung as a puppet.
And our Jane has such a way with him, eh, Miss Lippard?
Mrs. Flowerday dabs at the child's wet lips as he collapses back upon her.
A shame she never was a mother.
Well, now, well, perhaps. But if every woman had a husband and children of her own, who would be spared to help her? There must be some old maids. God makes work enough for them.
The baby grunts in Miss Crawford's arms.
You did not marry?
Suki asks her. It is an idiotic question, but she wishes the lady would answer in her own words.
She was disappointed by a sailor,
says Mrs. Crawford in a hoarse stage whisper. An officer in the East India Company, says Miss Crawford, drawing the child back to her chest.
Had her wait all her best years for him.
He was posted abroad.
And never returned for her.
He drowned.
And so it is a comfort that we are able to supply her with occupation, although, of course, it cannot compare to holding one's own child.
"She is so good, I do not know how I shall get on without her," says Mrs. Flowerday. "I mean to bring her back with me to Essex, and she can care for him all the time."
"And that will be a relief to my husband and me," says Mrs. Crawford, "for of course we are devoted to her, but the cost of living being as it is, it were better for everybody if she were in a situation in which she truly earned her keep. My husband feels most tenderly for her, but that is his weakness. She was his favourite sister, even in childhood, and he swears he would keep her in comfort all her life, merely for the satisfaction of doing so. But we must allow dear Jane her dignity, must we not? I should not like her to feel as if she were an object of charity."
"And so to Essex I go," says Miss Crawford.
"We shall have such fun," says Mrs. Flowerday.
The infant begins to twist and whine. His face turns pink and grows pinker. His ears, in fact, are quite scarlet. He screws his face even tighter and snuffs once, twice. Miss Crawford bobs him on her knee and tots his fists about in her hands. But he will have none of it. He opens his mouth, and his first cry comes in a great peal.
"Oh, hush you, little fellow,"
whispers Miss Crawford, putting a finger into his mouth. But he has been duped this way before and reels back from her. His fury bursts from him in a roar, his gums bone hard. Miss Crawford looks up at Mrs. Flowerday. "Nothing for it," she says. The young mother is tugging at her stays and fossicks beneath her fichu.
"Oh, poor baby,"
she cries over his lamentations.
"Is he hungry? Hand him over, aunt. Pass him here quickly."
And he is handed across the table as if he were a plate of macaroons. Mrs. Flowerday raises an eyebrow at Suki.
"You see," she says, "there are some things that she may never do for him,"
and hoists her left breast into the room. She claps the child upon it, and the silence is immediate, except for her continued talking, which keeps time as she jogs him gently up and down.
"Put him out to nurse," Mama said, "the very moment he was born." "Certainly not," says I. "Nobody shall feed him but I myself."
"I put all my children out, and very happy we all were,"
says Mrs. Crawford, looking on fondly as the child sucks and grunts, his fingers splayed upon his mother's blue-veined bosom.
"I should have been worn to a thread if I had nursed them myself. Country women are more robust."
She looks to Suki as if she might have an opinion on it.
"You would think, to hear her, that I told her never to see him again. But a child, during its first year, is more of a burden than a pleasure. Why not put him out of the house until he can walk and talk and make himself amusing?"
"Nobody does that any more, Mama."
"And what of Mr. Flowerday? He cannot want his wife always so encumbered."
"He's glad to have baby about."
Mrs. Flowerday looks down upon her child's drooping eyelids and pauses for a moment, for her breath is taken by his feathered eyebrow and the perfect curve of his nose.
"He says he never saw such a natural mother as I."
And it is at this happiest, or unhappiest, of moments that Angelica, Mrs. Hancock, casts open the door and flounces in to meet her neighbours. Not since she left London has she looked so magnificent. Her hair is powdered to immense height and volume. How she has affected it with only the fumbling hands of Catty cannot be guessed. And her gown is sheer to the point of vaporous, striped organza through which the blue satin of her undergown shines. Her lacquered shoes clack on the floor, and her cheeks are a blush, and her lips soft as roses. The women cannot but flutter, for she is exactly as their imaginings wish her to be. Sweat breaks out on their palms, and they feel hot and cold at the same moment,
and they do not know what shapes to make with their mouths. For they apprehend that before them, pulled up to the fullest of her height, stands